for the place.
All right. All right, we're in for a real, real treat tonight, you guys. Our main speaker, we used to call him the Sober Living Nazi. Because if anybody who's been in the Sober Living House, you know that he runs a real tight ship, man. Don't be 1 minute late, 1 second late. Make sure your bed's made properly. You know, it was really an experience. And he told me something when I was living at that house, man. He told me that I was going to have to get humble before I got this thing. And I was like, man, you know what? You're a jerk, you know? But you know what? When the time came for me to get clean, I remember what he would told me, man, and I made the call to him, and I was like, hey, bro, will you sponsor me? I need your help doing this thing. And that was actually the dose of humility that he was talking about, was for me to reach out and extend my hand to another man and say, I can't do this on my own, you know? So I got nothing but love for this guy. He's somebody that I hold real dear to my heart. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce to the podium Leonard.
How much time do I have?
3 hours. 8 o'clock?
3 hours, yeah, right. My name's Leonard. I'm an alcoholic. At least in this time. I'm grateful to be sober, and I'm extremely grateful to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, particularly this meeting that's full of so many people that I love and care about. So there's two guys that sit in a bar, right? Like this. And they're drinking, and they're getting their drink on or whatever, and one of the guys turns around, and he vomits all over himself. Oh, man, I vomit all over myself. My lady's going to have a fit. Look what I did to my shirt. The other alcoholic goes, he says, oh, man, don't worry about it. Here, what you do is you take 20 bucks, put it in the pocket, which tomorrow when you wake up, she'll see the shirt, she'll see the vomit all over it, and you just say, hey, you know what, I was in the bar, a guy vomited all over me, gave me 20 bucks to go get it cleaned. So they keep partying, doing what they're doing, whatever. Next morning, he goes home, walks in, his wife looks at him, he says, what happened to you? He goes, oh, you know what? Some guy vomited all over me, and here, he gave me some money to get it cleaned. She looks at the money, she goes, he gave me 20 bucks to get it cleaned. He looks at the money, she goes, but there's 40 bucks here. He goes, oh, I forgot to mention, he crapped my pants, too. You know, and that was my career of alcoholism, you know. I would drink, and I would have these great ideas, and I would come up with these great solutions, and the very solutions that I came up would cause me more misery than the original problem that I had in the first place. And they just compiled and compiled and compiled. So, first of all, off the bat, I want to welcome the newcomers, particularly the newcomers that are comebackers, the relapsers, because I was a relapser. You know, and it's one thing to come in here in Alcoholics Anonymous with no hope. It's another thing to come in here, have hope, lose that hope, and try to get it back. You know, there's still hope. There's always hope. And I want you to know that there's hope. That black abyss that we have when we get here, it goes away. It does. It really does. So if you don't get anything out of this, I hope someone gets hope. So what was it like, what happened, what it was like now? All right, so I grew up as a military brat. I'm the only son. I have four sisters. My dad was in the military, and so I was the, you know what I was? I was an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. You know, my dad was a strict rageaholic. He was just a really angry man, and he was also a workaholic. He had really high standards, and part of that was because he came from a place where, like, you know, I can look back now and realize my parents were really poor. They came from a very poverty-stricken background as kids. So all they wanted to do was give us a better life. My dad had dad issues. He didn't have one. So he was really angry about his father. I can remember all of his life he was really angry about his father. The way that translated to me was he didn't really know how to be a dad. He was always distant. You know, so I spent my whole life trying to gain some approval from this man who basically all he ever gave me was just rage. That's how he got through life, was through rage. As a matter of fact, he died of a heart attack the day after tax day, you know, because he, for the first time in his life, he wasn't able to file his taxes on time, and it killed him, you know. It's just that irony of it, but he was just one of those type of people. And I had my sisters, and he grew up in a male-dominant society, you know. It's like, as a kid, all I had to do was take out the garbage. You know, my sisters did everything else. So I learned from an early age how to depend on women to survive, you know, and I also had this really sense of entitlement, as if someone owed me something, you know, as if just because don't you know who I am, you should do for me, you know. And part of that went along with the lines of by the time my father had it, by the time I was, I don't know, probably about 9 or 10 years old, my father had risen up the ranks, and he was quote-unquote the man, you know, and we lived in the military, and so I was always, he was big flip, I was little flip, so I had this notoriety about me, and, you know, I just kind of had this little golden thread that kind of just went through my life. Wherever I went, things seemed to work out for me, but on the inside, I felt completely different, and I felt like I didn't fit in. I can remember all the time watching my sister and my mom and then do their little thing, and I was just kind of out here, you know, and they would always tell me, Lenny, go play somewhere, or, you know, get out of here, and that kind of thing. So I always felt separate, very much alone. And my dad really wasn't there. So I can remember at a very, very early age having this thought of there must be something wrong with me. Or everybody else in the world knew a secret, and you guys weren't telling me about it. You know, there's something going on here, and I need to figure it out. And what happened for me was the end result was that I came to the conclusion that there was something fundamentally wrong with me, that there had to be something fundamentally wrong with me. And if you found out what that was, you would immediately reject me. And I'd live the rest of my life in isolation and, you know, and all alone. And I'd be ostracized and, you know, fall in this big bottomless pit. So I began to put on masks. And I remember putting on masks. I had a great childhood. You know, we traveled all over. You know, every 4 years we moved. I went from school to school. So I had a lot of experiences. I had a lot of external experiences. One of the disadvantages of that was that I was found it very difficult. I never learned or developed the ability to develop long-lasting, deep relationships with people because I was always moving. And I could always put on the good front, and I was a great starter. You know, I could pick it up and I could get in and I could make it happen. But when it came to longevity, oh man, I'm out of here. You know, and I can remember later in my addiction, I would always say, you know, my favorite line is I'll be right back. You know, and I would tell people I'll be right back, and then you might see me 6 months, 9 months, who knows, you might not see me at all. And that was my out, and I lived from that. And it became a skill. You know, and one of the things I know about us as alcoholics is that we, in order to survive, I had to develop certain skills. And I developed some really finely honed, well-constructed skill sets that worked really well for me, that helped me survive. Those same skill sets become character defects in recovery. And so those are some of the things that I have to deal with today on a daily basis, is these skills that work for me so well and so accurately and so consistently kick my ass today. And it's okay. I mean, it's part of the process. But, a lot of times in my recovery or in my sobriety, you know, I beat myself up for being who I am, and I forget that, you know, that part of me served me real well once upon a time, you know. So to kind of lighten up and give myself a break. Oh, that's something else I want to share too, is that, you know, one of the things I had to learn, that in that book, they talk a lot in that book about the process, you know, the process. And one of the first things in the book that it tells me is to lighten up, give myself a break, calm down, relax, it's going to be okay. You know, and, you know, I have to thank my sponsor for that, because for a long time I walked around here thinking, there's got to be something else I have to do. There's something wrong. What else do I have to do? And he would always tell me, did you drink today? Like, no. I said, all right, well, you're okay. If you haven't drank today, you're okay. You know, and I have to remind myself that, because I have a head that tells me that I'm not okay all the time, especially when I get to that place where I think I've got all my ducks in a row. I'm like, okay, I got it. And then the next thing my head says, oh, not good enough. You got to get this one right, you got to get that one right, and then I want to give up. You know, I want to give up. I have that sabotage syndrome that's part of my nature, and it's always going to be there, I think. I think I just have to accept it and move forward. So let's talk about my first drink. My first blackout was, I think I must have been about 10, 11 years old, and my parents just have these parties. They're in the military, they had these parties, and they would have a thing called a highball. And I remember they would have the half a gallon in these decanters that you could tip over like this, and I remember the Dixie cups and the ice cubes and the fun, and I remember walking around drinking all the watered-down drinks. You know, I would just drink and drink. And I remember coming to late, covered in vomit. and my family standing around me laughing. Wow, look at Leonard, that's what you get. You learned your lesson, you know. So I was a blackout drinker from the beginning, right off the bat. I was a blackout drinker. And I remember thinking, that sucks. I'm never doing that again. And ironically, drinking alcohol wasn't originally the first thing that I became addicted to. Shortly after that, what happened is at that time we were living in Germany and my parents split up. So my father came out here to Lompoc, California. My mother moved to Atlanta, Georgia, which was an absolute culture shock. And I was thinking about this today in the shower. Now you know, you get all these great epiphanies in the shower. And I think it's the hot water, the steam or something. I don't know. But so I was in the shower and I was thinking that, you know, when I got off that plane in Atlanta, I was absolutely just traumatized. You know, I went from this multicultural environment where the color lines were very blurred. I mean, it really wasn't an issue. And I was notoriety. I had notoriety about me because my father is rank. To this place where there was nothing but race. It was all about race. It was nothing but a bunch of poor black people. And of course, me having those finely honed skills that I have, I very quickly adapted. And what I realized today is what happened is I fell in love with the game. For those of you that don't know what the game is that alter world that exists out there where the good is bad and the bad is good, you know. And I fell in love with the pimps, and I fell in love with the con men, and I fell in love with the pool sharks, and I fell in love with the drug dealers, and those became my heroes, and I very quickly acclimated to that environment. My first profession was as a grifter. And they really do exist. And what a grifter is, a person who goes around, he's a con artist. He tricks people out of money. And I would go around learned how to shortchange people and do the three-card molly and do the short con and the long con. And this became my first profession. And I had never really even realized that, you know, until this part of my recovery. You know, a lot of things we just kind of push in the back of our minds. But what happens is with that mentality, the whole world switches. There's us and there's them. And either you're a player in the game or you're a mark and a trick, and it's my job to get you. And that became my first drug. As a matter of fact, I can remember I always had problems with alcohol. Anytime I drank alcohol, I had problems. And I can remember thinking, I can't drink because it's messing with my game. And this is, I was still in high school. And so that was my first real addiction, I think. I also became involved in things like prostitution and robbery. We were breaking people's houses. I mean, just that became the thing that I did. It was part of what we did. Of course, it didn't take me long to get in trouble. I remember my mother sitting me down and saying, look, these people have come to me. And of course, you know, they said, you know, either you get your son out of Atlanta or we're going to kill him. But basically what it has is what they told me. So she put me on a plane and she flew me out here to California. And I remember getting off that plane in California and seeing the pine trees and the sunshine and the burritos and all these white people. And I remember thinking, okay, yeah, now I'm back home. I'm back in my element. And the game changed. My whole mentality shifted. And I left a lot of that street activity behind, but it was very much ingrained in me. And I think I was in California maybe, I don't know, 6 months. And I started going to school and smoking pot. I started hanging out with the stoners and doing my thing. And all of a sudden, one day I woke up and a friend of mine from Los Angeles came to me and said, here, man, try this. And I go, what's that? And he pulls out a rig and he introduced me to intravenous cocaine use. And my entire world just changed. It's just a matter of time before I was out of complete control. My dad, he did the best he could with me, but I mean, I was done. I was already drinking and using on a daily basis. I was a chronic marijuana user. I'm sorry, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. I forgot. Part of my story is drugs. I'm gonna get through them as quickly as I possibly can, but I need to share that because I know there's people in here that need to hear it. I apologize. So I use daily. Basically, I use daily. The other substance is what really accelerated. I heard somebody share the other day about how what that substance did is it took my alcoholism and it pushed the pedal all the way to the floor, you know. And I began to hit bottoms really fast. My father started sending me to psychiatrists. He couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. What is wrong with this kid? And I acted out a lot. I'm an extremist. I'm just an absolute extremist. So I acted out of I was the worst out of my whole crew. I was the worst. And so I hit bottoms really quick, and my dad started sending me to psychiatrists, and eventually one psychiatrist says, you know, you need to go to some of those AA meetings. And I remember walking into my first AA meeting, looking around the room, and turning around and walking back out. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. You know, here I am 16, 17 years old, and I'm looking at all these gray-haired, long-beard people, you know, smoking lots of cigarettes and drinking lots of coffee, talking a bunch of stuff that I just did not want to hear at all. You know, don't you know who I am? And then that entitlement came up, and that us and them thing came up. And eventually what ended up happening is I got in a bunch of trouble. I stayed in trouble. I was in trouble all the time. But I started getting incarcerated. And my first major incarceration, they said, okay, and my dad had some influence with the judges. It was like that. But this was back in the day where if you got pulled over, they would park your car because they knew your dad and drive you home. I mean, drop you off at your front doorstep. And so, I mean, yeah, literally, I remember them doing that to me a couple of times. After I stole my dad's car on top of that. This time I wasn't going to camp. I was going to YA. I had done something. I was going to YA. And my dad manipulated this and manipulated that. And he said, okay, great. Join the Army. It's a great idea. So he said, all right, you join the Army. If you join the Army, you're going to camp. You're going to YA. So I said, all right, cool. I'll join the Army. So I got married, joined the Army, and proceeded to drink like a fish in the deep blue sea. I mean, my alcoholism took me places that I just could not imagine. And what happened for me was that at this point, and previously before that, but now my alcoholism, there was a violent streak inside of me that started coming out. And I was a lot of fights, just a lot of violent, traumatizing episodes. And I ended up getting kicked out of the military for almost killing the guy in a confrontation. And I came back to California, and I wasn't even 6 months, and I was on my way to prison the first term. And that became the cycle. I would go to jail, get healthy, come out, and run like I had lost my mind. That was my first prison term. So then the second time I got out, I don't remember how it happened. Let me think. Anyway, so what happened is that the second time I went to prison, I remember thinking, you know what? I don't know what I'm going to do, but I have to do something different. And I want to talk a little bit about angels. You know, I believe that my higher power has been guiding me through this whole process. And in that process, my higher power has put people in my life that have saved my life. They've been turning points in my life at every step of the way. That man who told my mom that you better get your son out of Atlanta or we're going to kill him was one of my angels. I know that today. Had I stayed in Atlanta, I would probably be dead. When I went to prison the second time, I got off the bus, and I saw a guy walking across the yard with a book, Alcoholics Anonymous book in his hand. And I remember looking across the yard, I remember seeing all these different groups to go into it, if you've been to prison, and thinking, what am I going to do? You know, am I going to go hang out with these Crips? Am I going to hang out with these guys over here? And I remember thinking, man, I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this. I've never been a very good follower, ever. And if I'm going to follow, then I'm going to jockey to lead, if that makes sense. And one of the problems that I have is that when you jockey to lead in certain organizations, it becomes very dangerous. It's very dangerous to try to, you know, be that guy. So I thought, I don't want to do this, you know. I had already kind of been involved in the gangs and things like that on the streets, which worked for me, but I did not want to do it in prison. I just knew that wasn't something I wanted to do. So I saw this guy walking across the yard, and he had an Alcoholics Anonymous book in his hand, and he was black, which was because you can't mix races in the yard. So I ran up to this guy and I go, hey, man, what's that? Blah, 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 blah. What are you doing? Come to find out, he was a lifer that had come down in points to the point where he was on a 2-yard, and he was part of a group that's called the Roadsiders. It was one of the first Alcoholics Anonymous groups in California Department of Corrections that allowed people from the outside to come in the inside. And there was this program that was called the Roadsiders. So I decided to started hanging out with the Roadsiders. And we'd go to meetings every week, and there was a bunch of lifers there, so I was off limits. So they couldn't, you know, the rest of the guys couldn't mess with me. I mean, I had a couple of interactions, but I was off limits. I was basically a member of, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I did that the whole time I was there. And I remember those guys telling me something, and, you know, and I remember them saying to me, look, young blood, we ain't never getting out. And so I want you to promise me that you're going to go out there and you're going to live life for us. And I never forgot that. I never forgot that. And while I was in there, I did what a lot of us do. I read an autobiography. Because, you know, I had to do the fourth step, you know what I mean? So I wrote this book. I had this book. I wrote this book while I was in there. And, you know, we halfway worked the steps or whatever. And I was paroled. And so parole came up, and it was right after Christmas. And they called my name, and they said, Flippin, you're going home. And I'm like, what? Yeah, we're sending you to a halfway house. And I'll never forget it, because the day I was supposed to parole, it snowed. We were snowed in. It was up at Tehachapi. So I spent 2 days on the yard of free man. I was pissed. I remember being really, really pissed. And finally, I was able to get on that van, and they drove me to Olive Vista, California, and they dropped me off in this little house. And my roommate was one of my homeboys, a heroin addict. And he since has passed away, where he rest in peace, Ronnie Munoz. And he couldn't stay clean. And I remember telling him, man, you just got to go to these meetings. I go to those meetings, homie. And the way I went to meetings, though, was this guy would come by in this van. Just this really humble, nice, sincere, loving, caring guy. And he would come by in this van, and he would take us to meetings on a regular basis, never ask for anything in return. He would just show up and say, come on, guys, let's go to a meeting. And I was taken aback by this guy. And a couple of things I want you to, that I need to share about real quick is that one of the things that happens in, of course, number one, being part of the game and being, being in the game, is that there's very much a us and them mentality. The other side of it is going to prison, there's very much a distrust for everyone, especially other men. So there's a double whammy there. Then you take on top of that the fact that I'm not real good about making intimate relationships anyway. It's really tough for people to get close to me. It's really hard, and I don't trust people. I still have that mistrust, and I'm sure people in this room that know what I'm talking about. Well, what I have found for me, that the hardest thing for me to do in Alcoholics Anonymous is to allow other people in, is to allow other people to love me, is to allow other people to get close to me. But that's the one thing that I absolutely have to do if I want to stay here. I have to do that. It doesn't work any other way for me. So I have this book, this autobiography, and I'm thinking I need a sponsor. And I'm looking around, I'm thinking, man, I don't trust these people. So I think, you know what, I'm going to ask that guy, that loving, caring, just selfless guy who comes by here every week and throws us in his van and takes us to meetings, I'm going to ask him to be my sponsor. And he was just ecstatic. He was like, yeah, Leonard, I'll be your sponsor. And I remember he took me out to the beach and we read this book, because it was a book, took us forever to read the freaking thing. And he never criticized, he just went through it with me, helped me to see my part in it. And I remember him taking me out there and lighting a fire on the beach. And I remember telling me this corny story about a phoenix and coming out of the ashes and all this other, you know, stuff. And at the time it was really corny, but I didn't realize it was a turning point in my life. It's an absolute turning point in my life. That man saved my life. I finished that program. I moved on. I never talked to him again. I went on and began to do my life. By this time, Alcoholics Anonymous had been kind of ingrained in my life. So I'll tell you a little bit about relapse. One of the things I found about Alcoholics Anonymous is if I come to meetings and I do what you do, Jim R. talks about the little duckies. If I come in here and walk like a duck and crack like a duck, I'll get the results of a duck. The problem is I will not necessarily get the inner transformation that goes along with being a duck. I'll still be black chick, whatever. What's that? The ducks and the swan, the ugly duckling. I'll still the black chick. Cancel, you race. I'll still be an ugly duckling. And even though on the outside I'm getting the benefits of Alcoholics Anonymous, like for instance, if I don't drink, I usually don't go to prison. I can keep a job. Matter of fact, I can even have relationships with other people. But I don't get the inner transformation that is so vital to this thing that we call recovery. But it works. So what I realized is that, you know what, I was tired of going to prison. I was tired of getting locked up. I was tired of all the results of my drinking. So I would come to Alcoholics Anonymous and the other fellowship, and I would sit around here, and I would talk like you talk, and I would walk like you walk, and I would get the results until, you know, I would get enough results, and then, of course, I would go right back out there and do what I always did. I would go back out there, and I would get back in the game because I still had that addiction to the game inside of me. I didn't know it. I didn't realize that I was still thinking us than them. I still thought that if I could just come up with the right con, with the right combination, some kind of way I could get life to work for me and work the way that I thought it would work. And I didn't know that that was my problem. and I would come in and out, in and out, in and out. And so during that interim, got married a couple of times, had a couple of kids, had some great jobs, had some really bad jobs, caught a couple of cases here, a couple of cases there. So I did this thing back and forth, in and out, in and out, in and out for centuries. So if you're here and you're back again and you're thinking, what the F? Okay. Don't despair. There's hope. It takes what it takes. It just takes what it takes. So, and that becomes an addiction. That's the other thing I want to talk about. Relapse can become an addiction. Am I done at 8 o'clock? Oh, I got to hurry up. So anyway, it becomes an addiction. Relapse can become an addiction. I can become addicted to going out there and doing what I want to do. And then when things get really bad, come running in here so that I can save my ass. And that can become an addiction. It's a very dangerous one because eventually I get to a place where I start to think that this is not going to work for me, even though I'm sitting in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's scary. That's really, really scary. And what it had to came down to for me is because I wasn't allowing myself to hit a deep enough bottom. I was so busy. It's like there being holes in my boat. And every time one hole pops up, I patch that hole, but I'm ignoring the other ones behind. I'm still trying to keep the ship afloat. Someone told me, they said, if I was in the woods and I saw a tree falling, would I try to hold it up? Hell no. I would not try to hold it up. Well, there's no difference being an alcoholic and my life falling apart than a tree falling. But I keep trying to hold my life together when it's absolutely falling apart because I'm a freaking alcoholic. I'm not going to be able to hold it together. And it wasn't until I let the tree fall, let the dust settle, let all the parts go all over the place it was, and then waited till the dust settled and then asked someone else to help me put it back together, was I able to get that change on the inside that made all the difference, that made the difference. I had to hit a big enough bottom. And for me, that happened about 9 years ago. And what happened for me was I kept trying to juggle the pieces and put the pieces together and make them work, and they just kept falling apart. And I kept picking them up, and they kept falling apart. And so what happened is that about 9 years ago, a little over 9 years ago, I had this great idea that I was going to go see my kids for Christmas. They were out of town. But inadvertently, my truck had gotten impounded, so I don't know how that happened. Might be because I was using some other substance. So I ended up riding the bus all the way up to Oregon to see my kids, having the worst Christmas that I could ever have, riding the bus back down, staying with my other second ex-wife, having the worst week in between Christmas to where the point where I woke up on New Year's Day, and I thought New Year's Eve, and I thought I just could not do this anymore. And I remember that moment where everyone was saying, hey, Happy New Year's, and someone takes a Bartles and James, and they go, here, Leonard, Happy New Year's. And I remember taking that Bartles and James and thinking, if I put this to my lips, I have no idea where I'm going to end. And I remember giving them back that Bartles and James, and I started walking. And I walked, and I walked, and I walked. I ended up on East Beach watching the sunset come up. And as I watched that sunset come up, I remember thinking, and I prayed to God, I said, God, please, don't let me ever have to live like this again. Please help me to not ever have to do this again and go through this again. And it was just one of those moments where something just inside of me broke. Within 3 months, I was in L.A. County Jail in one of the worst race riots in the history of that jail. Just a hugely traumatic event. My father passed away, and we had a couple of houses, had a house in Lompoc, a house in Phoenix, Arizona. We lost the house. I lost everything. Then, on top of all of that, I ended up in prison one more time. Behind the technicality, I was like, God, what are you doing? It's like, I'm trusting you, and this is what you're doing to me? And I was pissed. I was pissed at God for about the first 5 years walking around here. I was really pissed. But I wasn't willing to step back and take control over again. The reason why I share that is if you're new in the room and your life's falling apart, you're just going to have to let it fall apart. It's just part of the process. It's just part of the process. This is all the stuff that I had to do to let go of that. And what I realized at this, and looking back now, is what happened for me, is that for the first time in my recovery, I was willing to surrender to the fact that I was addicted to the game as well. But I was willing to surrender to the fact that I can't do it myself. That no matter how much game and how many skills I have in manipulating people, places, and things, it's still not enough. And I'm going to depend and rely on something other than myself, a power greater than myself. And it's been that dependence and reliance upon a power greater than myself that has driven me all the way to this point today. I got out of prison. with literally the clothes, with nothing, the clothes on my back. Not even the clothes on my back. I had to parole from LA County Jail, so I had to wear their clothes. And I remember having to hitchhike from Mintz County Jail to the parole department so I could get a bus ticket to Santa Maria. And I get off the bus in Santa Maria to go to a halfway house, and it's raining. And so I had to go all the way to the parole office here, and I sat down in front of that parole office, and I sat down, and I looked at it, and I just started bawling. I was devastated. I was that devastated. I just started bawling. And he gave me this little ID, which was all I had. It was that ID. And by the grace of God, I was in a halfway house on the corner of Cook and Depot. And I remember thinking, okay, here I am again. Here I am again. And I walked in this room, and I sat down, and in the interim, between this time here, I'd written another fourth step. So I'm sitting on another fourth step, and I'm thinking, man, I need a sponsor. And 20 years later, almost to the exact day, in walks the very same sponsor who did my first fourth step with me. He walks through the door again. And I'm thought, okay, God, here we go. And so I had a sponsor. And then in the middle of that, some things happened, and some men came to me, and they said, Leonard, what do you think about running a sober living for us? And I thought, well, you know what? I don't have any place to stay. I don't have any place to go. What else am I supposed to do? And I remember thinking, okay, God, here we go. And I remember moving into that house in there, and I remember thinking to myself, okay, so either I'm going to run this house on my principles, or I'm going to run this house on the principles that they told me to. And I ran the house on the principles that they told me to. And it was hugely successful for the men that went through the house, not because of me, but because of the principles that the house was built on. To this day, I still share a bond with every man that's ever walked through this house. If you've gone through Pathways, we have a bond. Not because of us, but because of that experience that we surrendered to that allowed us to do that. So I have 10 minutes. There's a couple of principles I want to talk about. The first principle for me, and the most important principle for me, that I have to practice here is that principle of humility. And for me, what humility does for me is it puts me in a place where I know that I don't know. It also puts me in a place where I'm willing and open to be teachable. The problem is that my addiction or my alcoholism is in my thinking. So anytime I think that I know what I'm doing, my alcoholism is doing my thinking for me. And the only antidote for that is that humility, is that honesty that, you know what, I really don't have this together. That's the one half of it. The second half of it for me is the willingness. I have to be willing to allow someone else to help me. Now, you got to remember something. Ever since I've been about this big, I've been thinking that there's something really ugly, disgusting, and just a horn about me inside of me. And the most important thing for me to do is to not only cover it up, but to make sure that you never see that. Because if you see it, my worst fears will come true. And what Alcoholics Anonymous forces me to do is to open up and to let you see who I am. And I got to tell you something, that's terrifying for me, for a person like me, for an alcoholic like me. You know, I would rather die in a hole alone than I would to open myself up to you and allow and have you reject me. But in that opening up to other people and letting other people in, I begin to heal in the slowest way, but I still begin to heal. And one day I start to wake up and think, okay, maybe I'm not that bad. Now, I wish I could sit here and tell you that I look in the mirror and I go, oh, my God, Leonard, I love you so much. You're so fantastic. And I don't. I still wake up every day. I look in the mirror and I go, I don't know about you. But it's getting better. But it's getting better. Most days I still wake up and I open my eyes and I go, oh, shit, I'm still here. But the difference is today I wake up and I open my eyes and I go, oh, shit, I'm still here. And then my second thought is, you know what, thank God I'm still here. And then I look around my life and I start to see that my life is working for me. I didn't think life worked. I thought life was a struggle and you had to fight tooth and nail to get what you get and screw everybody else and then you die. And that's absolutely not how this thing works. Life is about this wonderful, beautiful, thriving process in which I interact with other people and it continuously gets better. I didn't know that. I did not know that. I lived in a world of darkness and decay. Today my life is full of brightness and growth, and beyond hope. I can remember being so hopeless that death would have been a plus. And coming from that to this is an absolute miracle. Now, I love the idea of self-help because I really believe that there's a lot of things that we can do for ourselves to help ourselves. But when it comes to my alcoholism, left to my own devices, I am screwed beyond anything I can imagine. And I have to remember that. No matter how good my life gets, it will never get better than a day sober. You know, and I had to start learning how to look on the inside instead of on the outside. The most important thing for me today is not what my bank account looks like. The most important thing for me today is what my emotional account looks like. And what do I need to do to be okay with Leonard today? And 90% of the time, it's just a matter of reaching out to another human being. I have a job beyond anything that I can imagine today. I mean, I love my job. I absolutely love my job. I get to work with the worst, the broken of the broken, the beat up of the beat up of our society today. I get to work with men and women coming out of prison, trying to reintegrate back into society. That's an oxymoron. How do you ostracize somebody from society and then kick them back out here and tell them how to figure out how to get it back in on their own? It doesn't work. They need a process. And I get to help them through that process, as impossible as it seems. Because once you tell a person to get the fuck out, tell them to come back in just doesn't sound the same anymore. it just doesn't. And emotionally, it doesn't feel the same. So there's this big, huge emotional baggage that we walk around with thinking that I don't belong. And I knew you didn't want me here anyway. And I get to help these men and women heal through this process. Well, what does it do for me? Well, it puts me right back where I need to be. It helps to keep me humble. It helps to keep me right size. And it helps to keep me as one among many. I had a sponsor one time. He used to tell me, Leonard, you know what your problem is? He said, you won't be just one of the crowd. I said, what are you talking about? He used to tell me all the time, Leonard, just be one among many. And I'd be like, I am one among many. And I didn't realize that I was terminally hip and fatally cool. I was still addicted. I was still addicted to that idea of us and them. That some kind of way I was going to figure this out. So today, the most valuable thing that I can do is to surrender to the fact that I'm just one among many. And that humility for me is like the life-saving process of all of this. It's like the grease that makes the wheel go around. Anytime I get prideful and arrogant, I'm in trouble. If I can remember that when I get prideful and arrogant, I can save myself from so much misery inside and outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was asked to speak here, I thought, okay, so what am I going to tell these guys so I can impress them? You know, what can I tell you so that I can impress you? And it's not about me impressing you. It's hopefully that I can impress upon you that this process works. This seemingly corny. I mean, those steps are like, they're corny. I mean, it's like, I want to admit that my life's unmanageable. Okay, well, if I don't manage my life, then who is? And I don't know about you, but my life has been so screwed up right now that there's no way I'm letting go of the reins at this point. Not realizing that my life is screwed up because I am holding on to the reins. I'm the one that keeps making this, my life a mess. And so learning how to let go of that is a huge process. Well, I found a trick. The trick for me is that if I can depend on a power greater than myself, if I can get to that third step where I decide to depend and rely on something greater than myself, then and only then do I have the willingness to let go. I'm not going to trust something that I don't know anything about. So what I had to do is I had to come in here and I had to do this little thing. And I'm going to share this. So there's different types of wisdom. Okay. So there's the wisdom of me sitting up here and speaking with you so eloquently. And I just know that there's something here that came out of my mouth that just is going to transform one of your lives. Okay. And so that's a form of wisdom. The wisdom that I hear from other people. I come in and I tell people stories, and I hear them share their experience, strength, and hope, and I can get something out of that. What I get out of that is some motivation. I get some motivation. That's one form of wisdom. Now, the second kind of wisdom is where you go home tonight, and you put that book out, and you look around, and you start reading this, and you go, oh, shit, that makes sense. I get that. I get it. And that's a form of intellectual wisdom. It's something that I figured out on my own. And that's good and fine, too. But none of that type of wisdom is worth a hill of beans if I don't get the third type of wisdom. And it's called experiential wisdom. And that's the wisdom where I come in here and I sit down and I don't drink, even though I want to drink. And all of a sudden, the obsession goes away. Now, the first time that happens to me, it's an absolute miracle. Because now I experientially know that if I don't put a drink in my mouth, I won't get drunk. Now that sounds really simplistic, but I don't know about you, but for me, that was epiphany beyond anything you can imagine. Well, that's true for every principle that we talk about in here. So I talk a lot about humility. So the thing is that you can hear me talk about humility and go, okay, that's great, Leonard. Or you can read about humility and intellectually understand it. Or I can go out there and humble myself and watch how my life changes. Alcoholics Anonymous is an experiential program. I have to do the shit that you tell me to do before I actually get the results. Now, that sounds real simple, but I don't know about you, but where I came from, I wanted to know that it was going to work before I did it. You had to prove to me that it was going to work, and if I had any doubts that it wasn't work, I ain't wasting my time. I'll just sit here in my misery until I die. And it wasn't until I started to realize that this was an experiential program that I had to begin to do the stuff that you guys told me to do in order to get the benefits of what you get. So I was sitting up on this mountain, and they were talking about these principles, and the light went on inside of me. I'm sorry, I was sitting up on a mountain meditating, and I was and it came on to me, and it was like, Leonard, you know what your problem is? You're not putting enough effort into the experiential aspects of life. You're not doing the things that you need to do in order to experience life. You're thinking about what it's like to be experiencing life. You're reading about what it's like to experience life, when in reality, the only way that my life is going to change is for me to experience it. So when they asked me to speak, that's why I decided to put on this tie and to show up and tell the truth to the best of my ability. I hope that there's something that I said tonight that helps somebody. If nothing else, I want to leave you with a little bit of hope. Doesn't matter how dark it is, the sun's always going to shine somewhere. Doesn't matter how bad the past is, it will always get better somehow. And no matter how far down the bottom, the scale you've gone, if you just stop digging, you will start to go back up. Thanks for letting me share.
Alrighty. One more time for Leonard. Alright, thank you, Leonard, for speaking tonight, and thanks to anybody that has a commitment at this meeting. The speaker will be available after the meeting.
I take donations.
He takes donations. Alright. And I would like to ask, let's see, Joseph, want to press out?
Yes. Thank you.